Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. The House and the Senate are now considering competing versions of the Farm Bill, with the Senate poised to vote first on Monday. In some ways, the Farm Bill, though, is a bit of a misnomer in that 80% of the money goes for nutrition programs. The Senate bill trims those programs, but to a lesser degree than the House does. Another key aspect of the bill would change the way the government supports farmers, doing away with so-called direct payments and putting more emphasis on crop insurance. So in this second part of our program this morning, we're going to talk about the Farm Bill, what that would mean for farmers, for consumers, and for those in need of nutrition assistance. Joining us, Alexis Fernandez, nutrition policy advocate who leads the legislative team at the California Food Policy Advocates. Alexis Fernandez, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dale Moore joins us as well, executive director of the executive director of public policy for the American Farm Bureau Federation. Mr. Moore, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, David.
And Ken Cook is here, founder and president of the Environmental Working Group, a public interest research and advocacy organization which works on these issues as well. Ken Cook, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Ken Cook, as you look at the Farm Bill that's about to be voted on, what do you like about it? What don't you like?
Well, there are some things to like about it on the Senate side. First of all, we're going to largely get rid of direct payments, these subsidies that have been sticking around for years and costing taxpayers billions of dollars, even during boom times in agriculture, which we're by and large enjoying right now, not every sector, but certainly the crops that get most of those direct payments, for the most part, have been doing very well. Secondly, while we object to any cut in the food stamp program, it's a modest cut relative to what's happening in the House of Representatives, we fear, when they bring their bill to the floor. There's already a substantial cut in the program in the committee version of the bill. We also like the fact that there are some limits, thanks to an amendment brought to the floor by Senators Durbin and Coburn, that will modestly limit the amount of subsidies that go via the crop insurance program to some of the wealthiest farmers in the country. But there's a long list of things that we needed to improve. I would say we certainly could have used even stronger links between crop insurance and conservation requirements. We certainly could have invested a lot more money into healthy eating programs as opposed to programs that support just industrial agriculture. And we would have certainly liked more funding for organic agriculture and conservation programs. So there's a long way to go. We hope the public will stay tuned and get engaged in this. Our supporters have. We've had 60,000 people on a petition delivered by farmers to Congress just last week. So there's a long way to go. There's a lot to be fought through, particularly on the House floor, where things could really get very dramatic and exciting. I'm sure my friend Dale Moore will agree. It could be a pretty exciting House debate.
Well, let's work through that laundry list of issues then, because there are interesting aspects to each of those. Begin, Dale Moore, by let's focus first on this question of crop insurance versus direct payments. What is now going to be possible for farmers, and what will they not have access to that they had in the past?
Well, David, one of the things we take a good hard look at is, you know, what is the safety net for farmers, which we characterize as those farm program payments, direct payments, as part of that safety net under the current law. And we look at what we call the risk management toolbox, which is crop insurance. And there are some distinct differences between how they work, how they provide farmers some certainty when they're dealing with Mother Nature, as well as market price volatility. From our perspective, we understood clear back in 2011 that we were going to see the elimination of direct payments. That was something that had been put on the table in a bipartisan fashion by both House and Senate Ag Committee leadership. But what we were looking at is they took that elimination of direct payments, took the savings that resulted from that, applied a good chunk of it. In fact, both the House and Senate bills cut roughly 10% out of the farmer programs when you add in conservation and also the Title I programs. But as we get into the crop insurance side of it, that's something as a partnership between, you know, the farmers and ranchers as well as the federal government in terms of, you know, making sure farmers are able to get into the next year. Last year's drought that we saw in a number of parts of the country, without crop insurance, a lot of those farmers wouldn't have been able to plant this year.
So the basic trade-off, if I understand this correctly, is that gone are the days when a farmer might get a direct subsidy, direct payment for the government, kind of no matter what, no matter whether there were problems with natural disasters or price fluctuations, no matter what, they would get a certain chunk of change. Now that the help comes in terms of subsidizing the premiums for crop insurance, and that insurance gives a degree of protection to farmers based on whether or not there's a flood or whether or not prices go all over the map, right? So the help comes only as needed. Is that correct, Mr. Moore?
The help comes as needed, and each year, for example, you have a farm, and let's say it costs you $100,000 for the crop insurance to cover your crops on that farm. The federal government is going to pay about 63% or $63,000 of that, and that's kind of a bet that the government's making that, okay, we're going to help the farmer cover this in exchange. And something that Ken had worked on for a long time is trying to push farmers more into crop insurance and away from, you know, the type of programs that, like you said, like the direct payment approach. So with the crop insurance, whether you have a loss on your farm or not, you're going to write a check for $37,000, just like you would write for insurance. The reason the government is involved in it is because of the systemic risk that occurs. Last year's drought, when it hit Illinois, for example, you know, about 70-75% of the farmers took a big hit. In regular insurance, whether it's auto insurance or home insurance, you typically don't expect as an insurer or as one of the people buying a premium that, you know, 70% of the pickups in a particular state are going to get hit all on the same day.
Now, sorry to interject, but I want to move us also into sort of, because all these things are about trade-offs. Some of the money that's needed to pay for this crop insurance obviously comes from doing away with the direct payments. But some of it also comes, I assume, from making cutbacks in nutrition programs. The old food stamp program, officially known as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Are you comfortable with that, with cutbacks in those food nutrition programs, Mr. Moore?
Well, in the food nutrition programs, and Farm Bureau's policy on that is that we are strong supporters of helping those who are in need. The cuts that both the House and Senate have proposed look at the administration of the program, trying to address some of those issues to make sure that those who are truly in need receive the assistance. You know, it's been pointed out farmers who are not farming get the direct payments now. That's changing. When you look at the cuts in the Senate, you're looking at about a 0.6% cut, roughly $5 billion out of a $750 to $70 billion baseline over the next 10 years. The House side certainly has a steeper cut, $20.5 billion, which is about a 2.6% cut.
These, again, are in the nutrition programs, right?
These are in the nutrition title program. So when you compare that to the cuts in the farm programs and the conservation programs, even adding in the enhancements that are made to crop insurance, you're looking at about a 10% cut. And the monies that were used to enhance the crop insurance came out of those cuts in the direct payments. The nutrition cuts are kind of off in a separate category.
Okay.
They're a different budget function.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification. Alexis Fernandez, let's bring you into this conversation now and tell us what's at stake with these cuts. As Dale Moore was indicating, they're two different, and Ken Cook as well, they're two different parts of what may be possible. The Senate trims the nutrition programs by about a half a percent, $400 million. The House version is five times more, $2 billion cuts in those nutrition programs. What's the real consequence of that? What does that mean for needy Californians if that were to go into effect?
So both sets of cuts in the Senate version and in the House version are going to end up in families losing actual nutrition benefits. And in the Senate version, the change in coordination between SNAP and LIHEAP.
What's the latter program, please?
Right. So the Low-Income Home Energy Assistance Program,
okay,
coordination with SNAP, which we often refer to as HEAT and EAT, would result in about 850,000 households losing benefits. In California, that's about 300,000 households who'd lose benefits in the range of $35 to $40 monthly. And that's in the Senate version. The House version goes farther and would include those same cuts to SNAP via HEAT and EAT, and would also include cuts to the categorical eligibility program. And that would result in about 1.8 individuals nationally losing SNAP benefits, or about 200,000 households in California, and those are entire benefits. So those families would be completely cut off from the program.
Do you think, though, there needed to be some reform in the nutrition program? It's grown enormously, doubled in mm-hmm. size. Last year, 47 million people took advantage of them. And as I understand it, one of the changes has to do with eligibility based on how much you can, how much are in your savings. Used to be that it didn't matter. If you had a large savings account, you could still get nutrition benefits if your mm-hmm. income was low. That's going to change, on the surface at least, that sounds like a logical change to make. Do you agree?
Well, I don't agree. The cut to categorical eligibility would result in families having to hit a limit on their assets. And so what that was in the past was $2,000 or less. And really, we know that assets are one of the best strategies, or developing assets are one of the best strategies to moving families out of poverty, and to have families have to hit rock bottom before they're able to apply for assistance and really use all their resources is problematic for us in terms of thinking about SNAP benefits and helping families transition to being self-sufficient and moving their way out of poverty. So that is a big concern for us and something that we worked very hard to get here in California. And then in terms of the growth that we've seen in the program, you know, some of the policymakers who've pushed for the SNAP cuts have justified the cuts by claiming that the program is growing out of control. And while the SNAP cuts, or while SNAP caseload has indeed grown, the reason for that growth is that the program is working as it's intended. Past experience proves that SNAP growth is countercyclical. So as the economy worsens and need increases, SNAP caseloads will increase as well. And as the economy improves, we will see that decrease in SNAP caseloads. So for us, SNAP is going to cut itself.
Yeah.
It seems a bit short-sighted to cut it now.
Alexis Fernandez, nutrition and policy advocate, who leads the legislative team at the California Food Policy Advocates. We welcome your conversation and points on this subject. What do you think of the farm bill that's before the Senate on Monday? Do you support the idea of cuts in the food stamp program, or is that something that you think is not something we should go to at this point? What do you think of the idea of changing more to crop insurance rather than farm subsidies? We'd welcome your points of view at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can post your thoughts on our Facebook page or on our website as well. So Ken Cook, bring us back into some of the trade-offs that you're contending with here. We've laid out, I think, some of what's at stake. How would you like to see those resolved? And is there a way to properly support nutrition programs and at the same time provide the right amount of assistance to American farmers?
Well, I think there is a way. I don't think the Senate version of the Farm Bill or the House bill yet are there. And the Senate is going to be voted on, I gather, without any amendments on Monday. So their work is pretty much done until they now meet with later in the year, try and meet with the House Agriculture Committee and in the conference process and produce a final bill, if they can. So just a couple of points. First of all, I mean, no one is talking that I know of about getting rid of crop insurance. The whole question is, are we being too generous, not just to the producers who, as Dale pointed out, get a 62% or more of their premium paid for by taxpayers, but we also write checks to the companies that manage the crop insurance program. We write them, you know, billions of dollars over the course of this farm bill will be going into their accounts to help them service it. And then we also pay the lion's share of the claims. So this is a very expensive program for taxpayers, but it's still, on balance, we certainly think, a better safety net if we just manage some of these elements and brought them under control, reduce some of the expenditures, better than what we had before. And we were at the forefront of groups campaigning to end direct payments and reinvest in something smarter. We think crop insurance is smarter. We just think that we are still looking at a program that's way too generous, particularly to the companies, many of which are foreign holdings. And also, I think farmers could pay more of their share now. They used to until fairly recently. Secondly, the food stamp program. If you're in the crop insurance program as a farmer and you find yourself in a situation where you'll have to pay more, you can go to the private market and buy it. If you're a food stamp beneficiary, look at the situation you're in. If you are in the average household and you have a household income of more than $24,000 a year, roughly, you're too rich to qualify for the program. So this is a brutally means-tested program, in my view. And to encourage people to have a buffer to deal with the hard times, to encourage them to have very modest assets, is critical to helping families, as our other guest said, get out of poverty. We could balance all of this. Cuts to direct payments could pay for the most part, continuing the crop insurance program as is. It's working very well. We don't have to add any enhancements. We could have enough money from those cuts to restore funds to conservation programs for farmers, very important here in California. Plus, we could avoid the cuts to the food stamp program. So we could strike that balance, but so far we're not striking it.
Let's hear what our listeners think about this question. We're joined first by Stephanie in San Francisco. Stephanie, go ahead.
Hi. I had two comments. One, I'm a public school teacher in San Francisco. I've been long-term at the school, and in the past 4 or 5 years, our low-income free lunch program has doubled, at least. Most of our children qualify for that. We have a food bank program that's has longer lines than ever right now because people are really, really suffering in the city and having it. It's a hard time making ends meet. And then my own family, my husband and I, and I'm a school teacher. He's a nonprofit executive, and so we consider ourselves, you know, middle income. And we unfortunately had to move because of owner move-in last year, and our rent more than doubled. As well as our location, so we had to drive more and figure out all sorts of ways of getting our family to our various destinations. And if we had not had any savings for ourselves, we really would have been in a situation where we would have either had to leave San Francisco and lose our jobs or really been in a very bad situation where we couldn't have made it because just because of our circumstances. And to impose that on lower-income families that are already struggling, they're never going to be able to make it out of their bad situations unless they're able to somehow build a reservoir, just like your speaker was saying a few minutes ago.
Stephanie, thanks. Yeah, thanks for that. Let's go next to Ken, who I think has a different point of view on the question of assets. Ken, go ahead.
Indeed, I do. Thank you for taking my call. There are many, many older people in the Bay Area who are living in multi-million dollar homes that have been paid. And these people are huge beneficiaries of Proposition 13, i.e. they are paying property taxes based on assessed values.
I understand, Ken, but that's not our topic. Yeah, Ken, thank you. Thank you. I'm going to let you go, but thank you. I understand your concern about that, but Prop 13, although it is an important topic and always will be in California, it's not our topic at the moment. Peter writes, the bill, I believe, carries protection for Monsanto and prevents labeling of GMO foods. This clause needs to be repealed by amendments currently under consideration. Ken Cook, is that right? What's going on with labeling of GMO foods in the bill?
Well, I think the Senate bill is silent on this issue. Dale, you can correct me if you happen to know otherwise, but I believe is not the case. But Representative King from Iowa has introduced a provision in the House bill that will go to the floor that that could threaten our ability to, going forward, have states decide that they want, for example, to have GMO food labeled, among other things, other ways it could affect state law. And there was a provision in an earlier piece of legislation that will expire in October. That was the so-called, Monsanto giveaway that would chill litigation, federal litigation, on a lot of GMO crops that are coming to the marketplace if, in the view of the court's adequate environmental review had not been completed. So Congress took action to take that option away from the courts, and that is not part of the Senate bill that's moving forward. It remains to be seen what provisions might be in the House bill and what might be in the final bill. Dale, is that your understanding?
It's my understanding. I would add the clarification, though, that it's not a Monsanto bill. What it is language that helps producers where they have taken a taken advantage of some of the technology that comes out, whether it's in reducing the pesticides they use or better drought tolerance, et cetera, through the biotech crops and varieties that are available. And if they plant that crop in good faith, because USDA has cleared it, and then someone goes to court and the courts decide to stop the process, we've had situations where farmers have been stuck having planted a crop in good faith that had cleared the regulatory hurdles at USDA and then have the courts stop that process. We think that the farmer ought to be able to have, at least harvest that crop so that we don't end up putting their, financial wherewithal in jeopardy. It's more provision to help those farmers that have taken advantage utilizing new technologies, yet at the same time, recognizing there's going to be an ongoing battle until some of these issues get resolved. But we're just trying to provide some certainty for farmers, if they plant a crop that has been cleared, that they're able to harvest that crop and not suffer the economic consequences of having to destroy the crop.
Let's hear next from Tom in Los Gatos. Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I've heard that the food stamp program actually started as a result of World War II because millions of soldiers were turned away, or potential soldiers, because of really extremely poor nutrition. They're basically very sick and stunted, even though they're maybe only 19, 20 years old.
Tom, your line is breaking up, so can you just get to your question quickly, please?
Yeah, the people in the poorest of the poor are actually the people working in agriculture here in California and rely on food stamps the most. And they're actually reducing their family size because of their extreme poverty and poor nutrition. So this has been counterproductive in terms of national security and just humanitarian concerns to cut back food to the primary agricultural workers and their families.
Tom, thanks. Alexis Fernandez, can you comment on that? It's an interesting point to think about the fact that the very people who are harvesting our crops are sometimes those who are in need of nutrition assistance.
Yes. I mean, I don't have specific data on that with me, but it is true that many food stamp recipients, CalFresh recipients here in California, are migrant workers, laborers, folks who are making a rather low income and use food stamps to really boost their household resources.
I want to see if I can get some understanding on the question of how these the crop insurance works, because I'm not quite clear on it yet. So maybe you can help me deal more on this. Does it? One thing that strikes me as a bit odd and is why we should pay 2/3 of someone's insurance bill. I mean, someone who is a doctor doesn't get someone paying 2/3 of their malpractice insurance. Someone who is a lawyer doesn't get 2/3 of their insurance paid, so forth and so on. What is it about farming that means we really should take care of 2/3 of your insurance bills?
Well, first I would point out that a lot of folks that receive health insurance do have some level of subsidy, whether it comes if you're a federal government worker, for example. The government
right. I'm saying in your profession, if I'm a doctor and I don't have someone who's paying my malpractice insurance.
There are a couple of reasons. You go back historically, the late 70s, early 80s, a variety of some market-driven, some weather disasters that started occurring with enough frequency that Congress was doing what are referred to as ad hoc disaster bills. And a lot of the questions that got raised over roughly a decade said, why are we, if we've got a farm bill that's supposed to be the safety net, why do we need these ad hoc disaster programs? Why aren't farmers making better use of the federal crop insurance program? And the federal crop insurance program is essentially run through private companies. It's a partnership on that end as well. And in 2000, Congress made a number of changes to the federal crop insurance programs that basically encouraged, provided the means for companies to develop new products and for, to spread the mix of commodities that were covered. There's approximately 90-some different commodities that have some type of crop insurance available to them. The idea was that, again, getting back to the systemic risk side of it, that when you have a widespread drought or flooding or hurricane or whatever other thing that Mother Nature wants to throw at us, when the farmers have that certainty through the crop insurance, there's less political pressure to do an ad hoc disaster program. That, over time, saves the government money.
Let me hold you there because we're almost out of time and get Ken Cook and Alexis Fernandez to come in with a last thought. And is your concern, Ken Cook, that this is insurance is a good idea, but we're just being too generous?
That's basically it. I think we need to cut back at this point the benefits that are going both to the farmers, but in particular to the insurance companies. They're making 14% or so on their profit on their investment through crop insurance, largely because we're being so generous to them. A lot of that money is going to the holding companies for the crop insurance businesses that are located overseas. So there's plenty of room here for some savings. I would say there's much more room to deal with savings here, far more than there is when we're dealing with hungry Americans.
And Carl tweets in on that point that we ought to tie the food stamps program and the crop insurance programs together. They're both social welfare programs, he writes, and they're both programs with merit. Alexis Fernandez, as you keep your eye on things over the next few weeks as the House and Senate vote on mm-hmm. these, what are you going to be pushing for, and what are your odds, I guess, that you're going to be able to accomplish that?
The odds are difficult. We're urging folks to call their representatives and really reiterate to them the importance of SNAP benefits and share their personal stories, make a case for the benefits and the importance that they play in their constituents' lives, and really staying strong to the Protect SNAP message that we've been carrying through these last couple weeks.
Alexis Fernandez, nutrition policy advocate with the California Food Policy Advocates Organization. Thanks very much, Alexis, for being part of our program.
Thank you.
Dale Moore, thank you as well, Executive Director of Public Policy for the American Farm Bureau Federation.
Thank you, David. I always enjoy a chance to argue with Ken a little bit.
And Ken Cook, thanks for being part of the argument, founder and president of the Environmental Working Group. Thanks
My
to
pleasure.
You.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi and Judy Campbell. Amanda Stupai is our engagement producer with online assistance from David Marks. Howard Gelman is our engineer today. Dan Zoll is our senior editor, and Raul Ramirez is our executive producer. In the hour ahead, we're going to turn our attention to the first-person experience of first responders, those who go out on those emergency calls that we all depend on. We're going to hear something about what their lives are like, the stories that they can tell us, and what it is that they do to deal with the stress in their lives. We'll hear that coming up in our second hour of Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.